Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Ursula Le Guin's story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, describes a utopian city where everyone lives good lives, except for the neglected child chained in the basement. Portland, which prides itself on its progressive attitudes, also has such a metaphorical child. The communities in North and Northwest Portland that were once thriving neighborhoods, now displaced and defiled by the growing pains of the Port of Portland. Today we talk with Elijah Cetus with the Braided River Campaign about how this coalition of neighborhood groups and climate activists has organized to tell these forgotten stories as they address city and regional policies that have created industrial sacrifice zones along the Willamette River. Elijah, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hey, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
I think a lot of people in the Northwest, when they think of polluted, toxic ports, think about the port of Tacoma, maybe the port of Anacortes, places where there's large oil refineries and chemical industries and lots of huge fossil fuel tank farms. They don't think about Portland. However, if you look really closely, you'll see that there is a rather large port presence in Portland, and it contains a lot of kind of alarming items. If you drive up Highway 30 on St. Helens Road, there's this strange anomaly. On your right are all these tank farms and all this very industrial stuff. On your left is Forest Park. And I wonder, Elijah, as somebody who grew up in North Portland, what's your sense about that presence on the right, and how do we come to terms with it?
It's a good question. It's something I've really been thinking about for the past year or so as I've moved back to Portland. But I grew up in North Portland and grew up playing in St. John's and near the cut where the railroad goes through the peninsula, and now oil trains pass through, and we'd see the whole tank farms and the industrial area across the river. But we didn't really see it very much. It was just sort of this industrial landscape that seemed to have sort of always been there. I think it's not something that folks, especially folks who move to Portland or who move to North Portland, are necessarily always aware of, or at least maybe don't have words to think about it. We know that this is Portland, and we have port activities here, and we move in grains, etc. But I think a lot of people don't realize that Portland is also the home of 90% of Oregon's fossil fuels at any given moment. And it's a marine port, so the Willamette River used to be really shallow, sort of wide river plain here in North Portland where it meets the Columbia River, and over time it's been dredged and it's been deepened, and now we see marine tankers that come, all the way up the river to Portland. But something that changes is when you start to have conversations with people who have been in the area for a long time, they start to talk about some of the changes that have happened over the years, and especially older residents who grew up here. I think they have a very different relationship to that industrial area because they've lived through its development, and they've seen the way it changes. One of my favorite signs in North Portland, sort of going up Greeley as I go home, is a sign that says, "Welcome to the Peninsula, Gateway to Nature." And I always thought it was so funny because I think of North Portland now as, being close to the West Hills and close to the river and some really beautiful places, but also as a very industrialized part of our city. And so there's sort of still this remnant of the gateway to nature that we see.
We'll get back to that gateway to nature as maybe a future vision. But I wanted to talk about this concept of a braided river. The organization that you're working with, or the coalition, is called the Braided River Campaign. What is a braided river, and what is this particular braided river that you're focusing on?
Braided river has come to mean, I think, a lot of different things for members of our campaign. We formed in the past year and really formed to try to bring up the history of the industrial area and to try to sort of revive the stories that we had heard of how it was developed and the communities that were displaced through that process, in the hopes of addressing the ongoing risks there, and in the hopes of having a community conversation about really the future of the river. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit, but I think that we settled on the metaphor of a braided river in part because it was an image that had captured each of the members of the campaign. Many of us are residents of North Portland. Many of us have worked on the river around environmental and community health base and just sort of advocacy for its cleanup. And then many of us are in the climate movement, but we sort of came together because, in part because of this image of a braided river, which is the how the river was before it was dredged, before the industrial areas were built up. And it really was braided in the sense that it was a shallow river that at one point, you know, people say you could walk across it from Linton over to St. John's. And there were ferries that connected Linton and St. John's. And the communities were really sort of part of one larger area. And they were separate towns from Portland. But so that image of a braided river also, I think, draws for us a connection to how the Willamette River is more than the sum of its specific uses right now. It's more than the fossil fuel hub. It's more than individual communities that have been cut off from it, and that there's an interconnected and sort of deeper relationship. And that relationship is historical. You know, we're braided together with the very intentional choices that land use planners and city officials and private industries made to control and develop these parts of the river. And we're also braided together with the communities that have been displaced and yet remain with tribal people who were also displaced and yet retain tribal treaty fishing rights. And we're braided together, I think, in a continuum too with the future use of that area. And I think it's an image that for us calls up the past in the hopes of having a more comprehensive and a more interconnected sort of vision for what the future could look like, because it's an area that has been isolated and its uses have been constrained, and I think it's just no accident that we just don't think about all that industry and all that pollution.
Well, I want to get deeper into that whole image of the braided river, because that's a phrase I actually didn't learn probably until about 25 years ago when I started learning more about the rivers and the watersheds in the Northwest. And when I would talk to people about the original way that the Willamette River was before it started to become industrialized, and that's when I learned this term braided river. So one of the things that I've been trying to do in my life and my work in the last 25 years or so is to really try to visualize what this landscape was like before it was industrialized, before it was westernized. And so I've looked for parts of the Willamette River that still have that braided quality. And I think maybe one of the best ways to define it is that the river used to be full of these little islands and big islands. And I can think of only a couple places around the Portland area where they're still there. Actually, where I live in Selwood, there's Ross Island Complex, or as some of my neighbors used to call it, the Ross Island Archipelago, which has been majorly changed by the Army Corps of Engineers and by dredging, but you can still see it. Another place, of course, the big place is Sovie Island, and then all the islands that are in the Columbia Channel that go all the way to the estuary. So how would you describe that, those places that remain, and compare that to what used to be, like, for instance, Swan Island? That in itself is a clue to what used to be there.
I think it's helpful you bring up the river in its sort of the South Reach, as we call it, but south of Portland, where there are still islands, where it's you can see the old sort of flood plains, and you can see the native species that grow there, and then Savi's Island as well. You know, the whole river in Portland, as we see it, has been very developed. The big flood walls that were developed along the downtown area, and then sort of building out from piers and wharfs that you know were areas of trade, and then also big shipyards in North Portland, and then through dredging that river has really changed. But it's still there, and you can still sort of see the geography like that. The deeper geography, just like the deeper value of the landscape, they don't really go away. So even Highway 30, you know, the most industrialized part of the North Reach, maybe, it still curves as you drive along it, leaving downtown. And that curvature itself is along the remnants of an old lake bed, the Giles Lake area. And the industrial sanctuary that's there now still carries that name, Giles Lake. And that part of the river was slowly over time filled in. It was seen as a swamp. It was seen as a place where disease and infection came from. And this is there's a long history of European settlers sort of in the process of colonization taking wetland areas and viewing them as wild, viewing them as places where Native American people were, places that were damaging to progress and to the city they wanted to build, and then filling them in. And that's what we saw happen in North Portland. The Giles Lake area, where the industrial hub now sits and the fossil fuel hub sits, was a traditional gathering place of Shinnecan-speaking people, also Northwest tribes throughout the area who'd come to trade. And it was a busy, busy working waterfront. But, you know, as settlers moved there, and especially as industry moved there, they saw it as sort of wasted land. And over time, began to, you know, create these efforts to control the waterways. And they didn't work always as planned. So in beginning in the 19-teens and then 1920, the city of Portland actually elected a 15-person commission to figure out how to build up an industrial area on Giles and Kittredge Lakes, which were wetlands, and there were farmers there, and there were fishermen. And they went about proposing a sort of massive investment where the Port of Portland would take over a huge part of that area. And eventually that did happen, but at first it was shut down. It was opposed by the city and by residents and even industry because it was too costly. They couldn't control the water. And sort of they would block off one area and start to fill it in, and then it would flood up on someone else's property. So it doesn't really go away. And I like to think about when I'm in the industrial area, and sort of one of the first things that made me realize that there was, this area wasn't permanent, and that there was a past and a new future that was sort of possible with the river, was thinking about the shape of that lake bed, the way that geography is still there, and the way that there are streams that still pass into the river and are currently buried, but still sort of that shape is still there.
Well, let's talk a bit about the relationship between Forest Park, which is this interesting, it's not a remnant at all. It's like this vast urban wilderness area that's right abuts this industrial area. And how do you see the relationship between these two zones?
I think on the one hand, it says something about the propensity for governments and cities and urban planners to designate certain areas of a city or of a landscape as beautiful, you know, thinking about like national parks, for example, and places that are deemed natural and where, you know, where we shouldn't intervene, and then the wetlands were not those places. And so it was totally comprehensible for them to have this really, quite beautiful forest and a important habitat and area, and then take the wetlands that were just nearby and change their uses. I think it's a juxtaposition that is in some ways something I think about for a lot of Portland, where we do have a very beautiful city, and people move to the Northwest and they see the you know, the forests and the mountains and sort of the image of the West is still very strong here, especially for new residents, but all of the ways in which the cities were built, and the intense resource extraction and the intense colonization and land speculation that had to happen, that sort of exists alongside those areas, like the Columbia River Gorge too, where it's this national scenic area and it's so beautiful. And then at the same time, we have bomb trains carrying crude oil and trains carrying coal and moving through that same stretch. And I really think as a culture and as a city, I think we need to do better to learn and to know our history in the Pacific Northwest, and to sort of break down that myth of an unaltered landscape, because only then can we really start to see how it was built, and then how we can move forward without areas being deemed completely empty or useless or just sacrificed places, like North Portland has been and continues to be, to the pollution and industry of the area.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG on KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Elijah Cetus, who's with the Braided River Campaign, about how they are trying to transform city and regional mindsets and policies that have created industrial sacrifice zones along the Willamette River. Before we get into the work that you're doing, I wanted to follow up on, you're just talking about who was there on this, living on this landscape, thriving on this landscape. before it became industrialized. So who were the communities and what kinds of patterns of settlement and use did they make of this land back until, what, 100 years ago or so?
First, there were indigenous peoples of Chinookan speaking dialects. So you had bands of the Kathlamet, the Multnomah, the Clackamas, among others, had village sites all throughout North Portland. And it was a place that was busy. It was a busy working waterfront. The way it's been told to me is, you know, picture canoes laden with salmon, berries, wapato, camas, passing back and forth from the upper Columbia down to the Willamette, stopping in Portland, where Portland is now, and then going down to the Salila Falls, another, you know, much larger regional areas of trade. And then, you know, when settlers started to come, Lewis and Clark actually stopped in North Portland. It's sort of a little known part of history is they camped sort of where Cathedral Park is now. And they saw something like 26 different village sites through the Willamette River. And then as settlers moved in, it was a farming community in Linton and sort of south close to Portland. There were farmers, people who fished. There were migrants, Chinese and other peoples from Asia who gardened and worked as farm hands there. And then beginning in the 1920s, or actually a little before, sort of beginning with World War I, we saw some of the first industrial sort of shipbuilding areas in North Portland, and African-American families who were sort of fleeing racial apartheid and through the Great Migration moved not only to the Midwest and the North, but out to Portland through the Second World War as well. There were federal housing projects that were built. So the most famous was Vanport, which had 40,000 people there at one time. But then actually Giles Lake, where the fossil fuel hub is now, was the site of the second largest federal housing project. And there were 10,000 people living there at its peak. These African-American families came and worked on the shipyards. And then as the war came to a close, the federal housing area of Giles Lake was slowly deconstructed. So that land had been bought up by private speculators in the years before, and they, after the war, were sort of wanting to cash in on that investment, on the initial investment of filling the wetlands, which had already displaced indigenous people, had already displaced farmers, and then sort of this third phase, they displaced a lot of the workers who lived in the federal housing area. Briefly after Vanport floods in 1948, families also moved to Giles Lake, and there were many more people there. But then in a few short years, by 1951, everyone had been sort of forced out and moved to St. John's, to Albina, and elsewhere. And that was sort of the last large communities in Giles Lake. Of course, the neighborhoods of Linton is right there in the fossil fuel hub, and people have lived there for a very long time. And there are actually still houses in the industrial sanctuary, just sort of tucked in amidst all the industry and warehouses. And yeah, so people are not gone, but there was a lot of displacement that happened as that land was slowly transformed to an industrial sanctuary.
Well, the community of Linton has always been really fascinating to me. And I, travel back in my mind to my first trips up Highway 30 back in like 1971, 72. And I was really struck by this community. It sort of comes as a surprise if you've only, been in Portland so far, and then you go up north a little bit. And there's this community that looks like it's right out of like the late 19th century. And it's got these incredible old storefronts with false fronts. And it had this real sense of connection to the river. However, even in 1971, you could see there was no connection to the river anymore. And then the other part of it is, in those days, it was before they put those apartments up on the east side of Highway 30. And so it was very, very wooded. And there would be these really cool little houses tucked in there. And I had a lot of thought back in those days, it'd be a really great place to live. But I didn't really think about what was across the river there. I'm curious about what you know about Linton and how Linton has actually managed to survive through all the industrialization that's happened around it.
It's been a hard fight, and I'm lucky that I've gotten to know some folks who live in Linton, and they have so many stories of, you know, neighborhood association meetings and meetings with the city and just sort of continuing to have to fight the encroachment and expansion of these really toxic industries. I also don't want to, you know, I want to be really clear that people in Linton and elsewhere in North Portland have worked in the industrial areas too, and they are, it is an important hub for jobs and continues to be, and there's really deep ties there. But it was painful, I think, for Linton residents to slowly lose access to the river. You know, you when you drive into Linton, you see this big sign of a salmon right there when you drive in. And there's all sorts of these signs in the Pacific Northwest of big salmon runs in areas where you don't see salmon anymore. It's sort of like haunting. But it was really true for Linton. There was big salmon runs that went up the creeks coming down from the West Hills, and people did do a lot of fishing. And right now it is almost impossible to reach the river from Linton. And that's a huge pain for the people there. It's a wound that's ongoing. And then on top of that, they live next to two pipelines, the Olympic pipeline that brings oil and gas from the refineries in Northern Washington. It brings it straight through their community, just something like 30 feet from the community center there along Highway 30. They're next to the Kinder Morgan pipeline that likewise brings fuel down to Eugene. And they know the risks. They're aware of the risks, and they know that they're breathing in toxic fumes every single day. I think the highway that was built there was another blow. Highway 30 was built right through the heart of the town, and people fought that when that happened. And I think it's so important for us to continue to really be specific about what's there, in part because this is what people live with. And for so long, it's just been sort of pushed aside. Linton has the highest rates of asthma in the city of Portland, according to the last report I saw. And they're a small community. And that's almost certainly from the highways and from the fossil fuel hubs and the industry there. Sort of the last thing I'll say is that Linton as a community has never stopped fighting. So they have a really active neighborhood association. And during the 2035 comprehensive plan, City of Portland, they fought really hard to have more protections from the industrial areas. But, you know, one of the things is that the industrial area has been over time really protected, and the sort of voices of industry has been really protected. So in the industrial sanctuary plan, for example, there's a section where, you know, as they're building the industrial sanctuary, they talk about buffers, and they talk about a buffer to downtown and preventing sort of too much pollution and industry that way. But they name explicitly that there's no buffer between Linton, the town, and all the industry there. They just say it goes right up against it.
Well, one of the symbols to me of the feistiness of Linton is this store, the Linton Feed and Seed Store, which is one of my favorite businesses in Portland. And if you go up Highway 30, just the little sign they have outside, which I remember back in 2001 when George W. Bush choked on a pretzel, they had a sign up for months that said, "Pretzel Drop-Off Station." And if you go by now, they have big Black Lives Matter signs up there. So I think that that's an indication that there's these remnant businesses there that are still fighting. And I wonder how they are connecting to the work that you're doing with the Braided River Campaign.
So we've had a few conversations, and just to kind of go back and maybe give a brief overview of what we're working on. We started, as I said earlier, as a group of river activists and climate activists, you know, who've been thinking about the fossil fuel hub a lot, and also the Superfund site and the infrastructure there. And, you know, our initial thought was we needed to bring awareness to the fact that communities are still here, and communities were here and were displaced. And so the first project we've started working on is trying to raise funds and find spaces where we can hire artists from the community to paint big murals and pictures of people who are displaced and people who are here. So we've had some initial conversation with businesses about that idea, and people are pretty supportive. You know, something that we've heard, though, through these conversations has actually sort of brought us over to our other goals, which is to actually bring about a community vision for the future of this industrial area and the fossil fuel hub. And through these conversations, we heard a lot that people were concerned about gentrification. And they, you know, and while they didn't like the risks that they faced and they didn't like the pollution, they were also concerned about losing the low property taxes, losing the, you know, their ability to have their shop right there in the industrial hub. And I don't know if that would be different with Linton community to being a much more sort of established community, but that was certainly the case for many of the businesses in Giles Lake, closer to Portland, and right in the industrial hub. I think we're going to have a lot of conversations, and I do think the feisty people who've been active and have been, you know, fighting this, the pollution, are going to be right there with us. I hope so.
Well, you mentioned several times this industrial sanctuary, and I think people think of sanctuaries, they usually think of places that are safety places for people and wildlife and habitats that are at risk, like a wildlife sanctuary. So what is an industrial sanctuary? I mean, is industry at risk and it needs a sanctuary in order to protect it?
That's a great question. So an industrial sanctuary really is like a protected area for wildlife or a natural area. So the sanctuary plan for Giles Lake, it was put together in 2001. And what it does is it says the industrial area in Northwest Portland is an important part of our city, and it's at risk, and we need to protect it as a city. And so just like a protected area, it sort of draws a line around where the industries are, and then it says, here's the kinds of land use planning we'll do, here's how, as you know, city policy planners and land use planners, we're going to protect it so that we don't lose this area. And I think it's an important thing too. Like, it was created in part because, you know, NAFTA and free trade and globalization has really decimated a lot of industrial areas where we've lost industrial hubs in this country. And I think the goal was to set out and protect the jobs and the industries that are important to be built in Portland and in the United States. What's so interesting about the document is it is like all planning documents, it's a piece of ideology, it's a belief system, and it's a kind of cultural artifact too. So that document sets out, in its justification, it sets out a vision for 2021, which was 10 years after, which would mark the 100th anniversary of when they filled in the lakes. It says, we envision, you know, 1,000 more manufacturing jobs, we envision healthy industries, and we envision them all working in close relationships with the neighborhoods. And while that's a noble vision and important, it only tells one side of the story. And that document itself was drafted with only one group of players, which is, you know, the industries themselves. As a group, the Braided River, we're sort of held on to that industrial sanctuary plan, and it's something that has just shown us really sort of what we're up against, which is an area protected for the profits of industries, and in a very particular way, and without including really any of the other sort of health and social and ecological and even economic considerations that as community members we think about all the time. I also just want to bring up one thing with it, which is, you know, it too had to reach back to history to justify itself, that plan, when they crafted it. And in that vision, they specifically say, you know, this was a site of the Chinook people, but it wasn't well thought of. They didn't use it very much because it was so swampy, which is a blatant lie. And it's just historically revisionist and ridiculous because, of course, the wetlands were areas where animals, you know, flourished, where you could harvest wapato and camas, and but it's interesting to me that they created a vision in order to preserve a very particular industry and area.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Elijah Cetus, who's with the Braided River Campaign, about how to transform city and regional mindsets and policies that have created industrial sacrifice zones along the Willamette River. Well, as you're describing this concept of wetlands as being these wasted, swampy, disease-ridden areas we need to get rid of, I used to live in one of those transformed wetland wastelands. I lived in Southwest Portland in Lair Hill neighborhood. And just at the foot of our hill was this amazing, what was this whole network of the freeway and the Ross Island Bridge and all this industry, a lot of it, which was kind of dying. And I learned that there was this creek, Markham Creek, that actually flowed under Arthur Street, right, you know, a block and a half from where I lived. And then it had its confluence in the Willamette River. And I was able to go down there and see the confluence, which is a big sewer pipe. And it's a very depressing thing to think about this rather mighty creek that you can see when you go up in the hills above Lair Hill. You can see the creek flowing above ground. And to think that this creek has been reduced to a sewer pipe. And that's true of creeks all along the Willamette River. And if we think about the Willamette River before industrialization, the whole, basically both flanks of the Willamette River, but particularly the east side, were all wetlands, and they're all paved now. And I guess to me, the saddest one is Balch Creek, which flows through Forest Park. And it's a very, probably one of the longest free-flowing above ground rivers or creeks in the Portland area. And then you can see at the beginning of Forest Park that Balch Creek flows underground through this culvert, and then it flows through the industrial area. I've had this fantasy for about 25 years of freeing Balch Creek. But one of the things that it makes me think about is how the what's called the industrial sanctuary has no environmental protections at all. And all the environmental protections that the city of Portland has celebrated that it provides for all of its residents, except for the people who live by the port. So what is the difference in the zoning that allows the industrial sanctuary or sacrifice zone, whatever you want to call it, to basically just ignore all kinds of environmental protections?
There's not really one direct answer for this. And it's sort of like there's complicated permits and who has regulation over what. But what we see is that the industries in that industrial sanctuary can receive permits from Oregon DEQ, for example, to pollute just enormous amounts. You know, this came up for us in the fight against the Zenith tar sands oil terminal, because what Zenith did in the past year, is they 2 years, I guess, is they took a facility that was handling asphalt, and they converted it to transport crude oil by rail. And, you know, the community was outraged, and you know, we really felt like there was no consent here. And where was the community plan? Where was the conversation? And part of the reason they were able to do that is because the old terminal that was there had just an enormous permit that allowed them to just pollute so much of different chemicals and air pollutants that they really, even in switching to tar sands, they just had a giant threshold to do what they wanted. Zenith was operating under an expired air permit, and that, you know, isn't uncommon. It's certainly uncommon the way Zenith operated, which was on an air permit that expired 8 years ago and was granted in 1995. But it was indicative of the kinds of permissions and just the way in which the city and regulators have really just allowed industry to do what they want and have really just rubber stamped proposals that come up there. And it makes it really difficult to actually step in and be able to regulate things that are toxic and dangerous. We were able to stop Zenith from expanding its oil terminal to bring in an extremely toxic chemical called MDI, which I'm not going to try and pronounce the full chemical name, but it's derived from fossil fuels. It's sort of like a plastic. And they were going to bring it through a pipeline under Front Street, right in the industrial hub. And the reason we were able to step in and urge the city, and then the city was able to deny this permit, was because of the Greenway plan, which is sort of one of the only environmental plans in that northwest area. And it's an area that says the Willamette River should have a greenway next to it, and it should be protected. And, you know, there's almost no trees there currently, but it still has that greenway designation. And so because the pipe was crossing the greenway, you know, we could say, here, this shouldn't be built. This goes against our city planning. It's terrible for the climate. It's terrible for health and safety. But without that small plan, in the industrial sanctuary, we wouldn't have had a tool to speak up.
Is Zenith, have they been stopped from expanding, or were they going to appeal the decision not to grant them that permit?
They were still applying for another part of that permit, and we thought it was sort of as a workaround. But then they, in May, during the quarantine, they announced that they were dropping that proposal, and right now they're working to expand only part of their original plan, and that's to build a new rail line to bring in, they claim, biofuels, so biodiesel and ethanol, etc.
So is that plan also going to be opposed?
It's complicated. I mean, we as a community, we oppose it. I think we can just look to Zenith's track record of just, you know, doing sort of going against their permits and never meeting with the community, flipping the fuels they carry. They've really been a bad faith actor.
Not just in Portland. I mean, I understand they're that way all around the country.
Yeah. Yeah, as many fossil fuel companies are. But that proposal itself hasn't been, the permit hasn't been granted as far as we know. You know, you can go down to Zenith and see that they're bringing a bunch of material and lining it up outside the facility. So they're starting construction. But, you know, Zenith doesn't have an air permit yet. It's still working on that expired air permit. And that's really where we have to hold them accountable.
Is that air permit, would that be given by DEQ, by the Department of Environmental Quality?
Yeah, they'll have to apply for Oregon DEQ.
It sort of makes me think that there's actually a whole lot of different levels that you're working on, because the DEQ has also been an enabler in the industrial sanctuary, so to speak, in Portland to really expand and do whatever it wanted, as well as city and regional regulations. So I'm wondering how that all interfaces.
You know, one thing we realized with Zenith pretty early on was that the ability of this terminal to flip and bring fossil fuels despite the 2016 ban on fossil fuel expansion was because of where it was, partly. And it was because of the protections for the whole area. The fossil fuel hub in Portland is an area that the city and the state of Oregon have, since learning about the Cascadia earthquake, have recognized is extremely dangerous. And they've recognized that it poses a huge risk to communities in North Portland. The facilities there sit on liquefiable soils, all that soil that was dumped there to fill in the lakes. And an earthquake would just turn to a sandy sort of like soup. There could be a massive explosion there, a leak or a spill. And while the city and the state have released reports and have been aware of that risk and have sort of called for solutions to address it, we haven't seen a clear plan for any changes to that site. We've seen proposals for, you know, there to be seismic retrofits, potentially. We've seen state-funded studies of the seismic risks, and they've called for there to be these stakeholder meetings to discuss how the site could be moved and how the fossil fuel hub could be, you know, made safer in an earthquake. But it's really unclear how that those changes will come about. And that's in part because of the way that this over time the fossil fuel hub has been so insulated from city and state level planning. One of the things that we've been trying to figure out as a campaign is, how do we intervene? You know, how as a community do we say we want to speak up about these issues? We don't want to just oppose a terminal when it appears on our doorstep. We want to have a voice in the vision of what will happen to the fossil fuel hub over time, you know, in the face of climate change, in the face of even state and city level plans to reduce fossil fuel consumptions. There's huge questions about what will happen. You know, how will that impact communities, and is there a way where we can call for a transition for the fossil fuel hub and do so while, you know, protecting the industries and businesses and communities that still sort of depend on those jobs. And what we've come to realize is that the way in which the fossil fuel hub is protected and continues to exist is, it's not only a question of regulation, it's not only a question of planning for climate change, it's also a question of the underlying assumptions that built the area and that continue to reinforce it. So there's a document called the Economic Opportunity Analysis, which the City of Portland updates every few years. And it's a plan that looks at the economic sort of value of industrial lands, and it looks at how the city can protect those industrial jobs and forecasts how it can prepare for more growth. This document, what's so interesting about it is it doesn't just describe the area, it also creates a legal structure around land use planning, because as a document, it the conclusion of it basically has to this date always sort of created the claim that there's not enough industrial lands. There's simply not enough available industrial lands to meet expected growth. And what that's done is it's meant that anytime the City of Portland tries to pass a new vision for the area, tries to change its zoning, change some of these, you know, these obstacles that are getting in the way of actually planning for the seismic earthquake and planning for a drawdown and a just transition from fossil fuels, any party, the industries there, can go to the Land Use Board of Appeals, the state court that does land decisions, and they can say, no, we don't have enough industrial lands. These industrial areas need to be protected. So it's a complicated question, sort of what's stopping action from being taken? What's stopping us from protecting, you know, communities or waterways, or even just having the conversations where you can reach a more of a middle ground between, you know, the goals of community members, the health of people living in the area, treaty fishing rights to harvest, and, you know, areas to have more access with industry. You know, these are the conversations we want to have, but there are really sort of subtle backroom documents that have historically prevented that from happening.
We're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Elijah Cetus with the Braided River Campaign about how to transform city and regional mindsets and policies that have created industrial sacrifice zones along the Willamette River. Well, how are you going to change that conversation? And particularly with that document, I understand that you have been trying to get involved in framing the upcoming revision of that document.
You know, the way we're going to do it is we're going to just try and step in and try and have a community conversation. You know, I don't think there's going to be a way where we can just enter a meeting and say, we're the community and we want to change this, that, and the other. It's going to have to come through grassroots just demands and through community dialogue that just starts any way we can. So we're stepping in first with this economic opportunity analysis, because the updates coming this year, they've already started to plan it out. And so we wrote a letter just as a group to the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And this letter outlines sort of what we think are some of the most important pieces of the context and really the risks and the just the story of North Portland that haven't been included in any of these plans before. So we talk about the history of the communities displaced. We talk about the need for economic opportunities that will directly benefit African American communities, indigenous communities, low income communities in North Portland. We talk about the need for protecting the ecology of the area, as, you know, one of the most important places in the Willamette River for migrating salmon. We talk about the earthquake risks. We talk about the fact that there's no plan for residents of Linton or St. John's to be protected from the consequences of a massive earthquake. And we talk about climate change, the fact that the governor's executive order on climate that was recently released this year sets a clear target to reduce our fossil fuel consumption. And here in North Portland is the place where 90% of Oregon's fossil fuels are stored, and yet nothing in that executive order and nothing in the state plans to address risk there at all ever mentioned the need for a transition away from fossil fuels and from the infrastructure that supports it. So we've come in and sort of had a laundry list of all our concerns. But most of all, we said, we want a community dialogue. And we're not claiming to be the community. We're not claiming to, you know, be the only people at that table. And we're going to work really hard to make sure we share this with folks we know and you know, in really important community groups in North Portland and labor groups and anti-displacement groups and unhoused people, just to create a table and see what happens. Because economic opportunity to us means a whole lot more than what it's meant for the past 30 years in that industrial area, which has been more industrial lands equals more jobs. Therefore, we need more industrial lands. And actually, if you look at the past EOA, they've started to move away from even that sort of simplistic equation because jobs have gone down, even as the cargo and the you know, the sort of economic output of the port has gone up. And so we really need to look not only at the sort of environmental and social concerns, but also at the labor concerns. How do we hire more people? How do we have different industries in the area that can also employ people? Are there opportunities for clean energy on the river? Yeah, there's a mess there, and you know, we don't know what it'll look like to fix it or to have sort of the vision that we share of a green, sustainable, working waterfront that's just. But we think through conversation and just through kicking the doors open and bringing everybody to the table that we can start.
Can we post your letter on our website?
Absolutely.
So you'll be able to find it on the website. About a year and a half ago, when people were protesting the Zenith oil trains that were coming through Portland in an alarming array, they planted a garden on the railroad tracks. And this was sort of a symbolic vision of what they were seeing. In fact, at that time, I think one of the demands was to change the zoning and turn this area into an open green space. So I'm wondering, how closely does that actually resemble what some of your visions are for this region?
I think that action carried the spirit of, I think, what a lot of people have wanted and felt. The audacity of them planting a garden right in this industrial area was just incredibly beautiful, because I think it asked us to reimagine what that area is, what it was, and what it should be. I think we can have debates about whether it should be a park or a garden. I think that's important, and we're gonna have those conversations. But just the fact that we could imagine that land beyond a sacrifice zone was so, so important. So my heart just goes out to everyone who was there, not only the first day, but came back that second round. And yeah, just really, that was a beautiful action. And I think, you know, I actually think the ongoing pandemic has been helpful too in shaping our thoughts, because I think it's watching business as usual sort of start to break down. I think also opens up new conversations. And then of course the uprising for Black Lives after the murder of George Floyd and now after Jacob Blake was so recently shot. That movement has just done so, so much for everyone's collective imaginations and hope. You know, I think especially the abolitionist demands that have become central to the movement, abolish police, abolish prisons, abolish ICE. I think there's a piece of that we need to learn in the environmental movement. And then as we think about city planning, and that's, you know, we need to be abolitionists about sacrifice zones. All places are sacred. And if we start from that position and we start from the point of view that no communities should be seen as sacrificial and no people and also none of the lands that they inhabit should be sacrificial, I think we can begin to imagine new alternatives and we can think about what a different future could look like.
Can you see a future where Linton is reconnected to the river?
I can.
What would that look like?
You know, we opened one of our meetings this past month with the question, you know, what does a green working waterfront look like to you? And everybody had different answers. Some people talked about union jobs and light industries that were clean. Some people talked about farms. Some people talked about bioremediation for the Superfund. You know, I always think about the ferries. I think about how Linton and Albina and St. John's were sort of one community connected by ferries. And I think about what opening up those connections can do. And so I picture, you know, I picture gardens and I picture industries and I picture people being able to travel between those communities, and really being able to go on the water again, and for that water to be cleaned up from the Superfund and just open. Yeah, I don't want to be too prescriptive, but I do think, yeah, it's a good exercise to just try and imagine what are the pieces of, you know, a more thriving and a more just landscape.
Most people in Portland really don't live that close to the river, even though we're the river city. And I feel like I'm really fortunate that for the last almost 40 years of my life, I've lived on one side of the river or the other. And when I lived in Lair Hill, I was living on the industrial side of the river. But now that I live close to where the river is braided, it's really reconnected me to the river. And it's also made me want to go spend more time in North Portland, too, and see the analogous. I mean, I live on the South Bluff. And then there's the, I think I call it the North Willamette Escarpment, which is right near the University of Portland and North Portland. And I wonder how you see bringing people who don't live close to the river closer so they can see what you grew up with and they can see what people who live along the river right now see in the importance of connecting with our river.
You know, I think it starts, just like you described, with areas that are open and are connected to it, to the river. You know, a lot of people go to Oaks Bottom. I live in Southeast now. I live in Milwaukee, and honestly, living close to the river here and close to Johnson Creek has changed the way I see Portland, having an open creek there and seeing the way the water travels and the way it's connected to each neighborhood and the way the geography of the city is shaped in part by the old geography of the waterways. I think that's something that we all can have a piece of. You know, that's the thing about water, especially in the Pacific Northwest, is it connects all of us. And I was visiting North Portland the other day and realized that, and I hadn't realized this before, that my entire childhood had been up on this bluff, you know, and on this high ground. And I realized, having lived in Milwaukee now, that the air up there is more open, and you feel as though you're on top of an escarpment. You feel as though you're on top of a hill. And of course, the river shaped that. And of course, the river is just right there down the bluff. So, you know, I think the more we open our eyes to the built landscape and to the natural landscape and the way we're connected to it, not apart, not like cities and national parks are two distinct things and the city is the place where nature doesn't exist, you know. I think when we start to see that the natural in our city, I think we're going to all feel more connected to it. And who knows what happens after that, you know, what kinds of radical things we'll call for when we all feel like we're part of that river.
Well, Elijah, it's really great to talk to you, and I hope we can continue having this conversation about the Braided River campaign and the projects that you have ahead to make Portlanders and maybe the rest of the Northwest aware of the needs of the industrial sacrifice zone here in Portland that we have been ignoring for so many years.
Thanks, Barbara. And I just want to, last thing I want to say is, you know, I've been speaking broadly about Portland and the hidden and us ignoring the river, but North Portland and the people of North Portland have not forgotten the river. Portland Harbor Community Coalition has been fighting for cleanup of the Superfund, and there are so many people that are still deeply connected and remember these stories, and I just want to lift that up and make sure that's really known. So thank you, Barbara.
Thanks for being on, Elijah, and thanks for all the work that you're doing.
It's my pleasure.
Today we've been talking with Elijah Cetus with the Braided River Campaign, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, in light of the intense fires we are currently witnessing, we'll rebroadcast an interview I did with Timothy Inglesby, Executive Director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, about how the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic are playing out with particular cruelty for wildland firefighters, and how potential major pandemic disasters sweeping through fire camps could ultimately leave rural residents on their own. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with River of Dreams by Billy Joel. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
To the river so deep, I must be looking for something, something sacred I lost. But the river is wide, and it's too hard to cross. Even though I know the river is wide, I walk down every evening and stand on the shore. I try to cross to the opposite side so I can finally find what I've been looking for. In the middle of the night, I go walking in my sleep, through the valley of fear, to a river so deep. I've been searching for something, taken out of my soul, something I'd never lose, something somebody stole. I don't know why I go walking at night, but now I'm tired and I don't want to walk anymore. Until I find what it is I've been looking for. In the middle of the night, I go walking in my sleep.